Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Hello, everyone, from the snow-covered jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana, and the sunshine of Santa Monica, California. This is Larry Batson. This is my wild world. Hope everybody survived the new year. It's going to be a good one, though. I have that feeling. 2010 is already looking up. We want to remind everyone that the program is produced and presented by Wildlife Educational Services, and we are a nonprofit company. Its entire mission is wild animal rescue and education. If you can go to our website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com, and you will see what we're all about. If you would like to donate to our work, you can do that through our website. Any contribution of over $25, you will receive a beautiful picture CD called Our Best Friends, different photos that I've taken over the years of our animal family, and it's pretty cool. Tigers and lions and bears and all sorts of stuff, so want to check that out. We've had some wonderful shows the last few weeks, and tonight is no exception. I've known his dad for, it's hard to believe, almost 30 years. I've known this young man since, I think he was about 6 years old. He's an avid adventurer. He's a member of the Explorers Club. I don't know if I should bring this up, but he is a Star Trek fan. But now he's in charge of his Wildlife Productions way out in sunny California, and they just did a fantastic documentary for National Geographic Channel called The Hunt for the Samurai Subs. J. Mark Fowler's here tonight. Good evening, Mark.
Hey, Larry. Good to talk to you, man. It's been a long while. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I was trying to remember the first time we met, though. It was up in Largo, Maryland, at the park that your dad
at the what was it called back then? It was called Wild Country.
Wild Country, that's it. And they were having an event. Of course, I didn't even mention in the introduction that your dad is the co-host of the old television program Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. And we drug some animals up to Maryland. I think he just condescended to do that. He had a knack for doing that.
Oh yeah, he's great at that still.
and we went all the way to Maryland, and we had a big outdoor picnic, and I think we did a couple animal programs or something. But it was, but you were just a youngster, and look what you're doing now, man. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, with you, with people like you as role models, it's been an interesting ride, finding my own path. Exactly. Yeah, we definitely had some fun. Now, do you remember what animals you brought to that affair in Maryland?
Well, I was trying to think.
Is that when you had the Celebes ape?
Yes. Yeah. Doc was with us at that time.
What an amazing animal.
He was special, I'll tell you. You know who we got him from? Did I ever mention that to you?
No.
One of your dad's best friends, Jungle Larry.
Wow, Jungle Larry, I don't remember him.
He was down in Naples, Florida. God rest his soul, he's passed away now. Though I think his wife is still running the operation, but it was Jungle Larry's African Safari Park. And
nice.
In fact, your dad ran into him in South America. I think it was in Bolivia, if he had told me correctly.
Yep.
And he was underneath a Jeep, working on this Jeep. They were putting a tranny in it or doing something with the differential. And he was under this Jeep working. All of a sudden, they hear this commotion. Here was this group of people walking up, and there was Jungle Larry leading them to the lost city of gold.
Oh, my gosh. You're kidding.
No.
That is perfect.
He had a whole raft of tourists that he persuaded them. into spending who knows what a piece to go on this expedition for the lost city of gold.
That's amazing. Yeah, we could definitely do a National Geographic special on that for sure. If Jungle Larry knows where the lost city of gold is, I think we should definitely follow up on that.
Well, I don't think he, I don't think he
no,
ever
but
found
but he did he but he ran into Jim Fowler.
He did run into Jim Fowler, and Jim still tells me about crawling out from underneath that Jeep and looking at. And of course, Jungle Larry, he was classic, you know. Even I think he lived well into his late 70s, but he always had that jet black hair, whether it was done chemically or whatever, and he always had the typical safari hat on and the kerchief and the jungle gym outfit. So he,
perfect.
You know, he was perfect. And that's how he looked in the jungles of Bolivia, walking up with these people with binoculars and things wrung around their neck. You know,
and Dad must have gotten out from the Jeep in a full safari outfit, too, since that's all he's worn for over my entire life, probably 40 years.
Yeah, I know. I'm almost in that same mode. But anyway,
there you go. Hey, I'm trying to evolve the look a little bit, but I think it's great that you guys are still, you know, strutting the stuff, the safari, the full khaki.
Well, you know, you got to have that look. You know, you're basically
just kidding with you.
No, I know. But well, what does a film producer wear? What's the typical?
Oh, that's a great question.
Hawaiian shirt.
Yeah, you know what? I just really slimy looking clothing.
Yeah.
To represent who we are. No, I'm kidding. No, you know what? It depends on the adventure we're on. Everywhere we go, you know, there's some other kind of some gear we have to bring, you know, whether it's muck boots or a dry suit or something like that. So, you know, every place is different, but it's usually the most extreme place we can think of and the most sort of fun adventure we can dream up, and then we bring that to the network and pitch the ideas, and you know, sometimes they go for it. So it's the adventure never stops. I mean, that's what Big Jim, Jungle Jim taught me was that, you know, the more creative you are and the more adventurous, the more life is worth it. So, you know, we've been doing that. I've been doing this. You know, I grew up with you guys as role models, so there was never a boring moment growing up. And then, you know, I was a falconer with Steve Hoddy, who I know you're having on the show pretty soon. Steve's a great falconer. So I worked under him for a lot of years and then during college I, you know, majored in wildlife and natural resources and natural resource management, et cetera. And then after school, just got into television production. And we did Dad may have told you when you had him on, but we did a wildlife series together with Big Jim as sort of the Marlon Perkins, and my sister and I out in the field doing the wildlife, you know, research. So we did a show together, and that's when I cut my teeth and got really into production. And we've been doing it ever since for about 8 or 9 years, actually 10 years now.
So what was the difference between, let's say, the old Wild Kingdom television shows that he was involved with and the producer, I believe, is Don Meyer? What was the difference between doing that and working with you and your sister?
So, you know, you mean with my dad with the Life in the Wild show?
Right.
Well, Carrie is much more beautiful than Dad or me. So there was a beautiful woman on the set, and Carrie's not afraid to wrestle an alligator. My sister Carrie, as you know, she's not afraid to wrestle an alligator or two. So that already got us rating points. It was nice working together because you know, he was at base camp and we were out there to go on adventures and sort of autonomous. And you know, I think it was an updated version of it, sort of a family version geared towards, you know, family, a family show with, you know, education for kids and for, you know, and to, you know, for so kids and families could sit down and be entertained, but also learn something interesting. So it was a lot of fun. We did it for 2 seasons and it aired nationally and internationally. And it was, you know, 26 episodes of going on some really great adventures together. So it's really how I caught the bug to become a producer, and working with Carrie and Dad was great.
So of those 25 episodes, which episode stands out in your mind, whether it be the, how does an animal person say this, a hairy moment?
Right, yeah, exactly. Like you don't already know those. I know you probably, you know, had your arm swallowed by some big snake or something before, so... I know I'm talking to the choir here, but you know, I think for me it was going and it was diving at about 100 feet in a shark with shark infested waters. That was a lot of fun.
Really?
And but I hadn't really I got my license that day, so my diving permit. So I hadn't really done too many, you know, 100-foot dives with, you know, nitrox and all this. So the guy who taught me was also the guy who we were filming for the show. So we went down there, and that was definitely an interesting experience, I'll tell you that much, with, you know, tons of sharks sort of in a frenzy. So I think that probably is up there. But, I mean, each one, you know, every animal is such a, you know, so interesting. And getting out there with the researchers and with the animal guys like you and you know, just getting into the thick of it and getting into the adventure, I think they all stand out. I mean, we did black bears and, you know, we did everything from black bears to wolves in Alaska to, you know, we went over to Africa and did a few episodes over in Africa. And actually the Masai Mara, that was one of the nice ones with the lions. We were, you know, checking out a pride of lions and we were able to see, you know, lions and hyenas fighting over a zebra was pretty amazing. I mean, you really feel like you're in the heart of it. So that was, I think that one stands out a lot too.
So what was it like growing up with your dad being Jim Fowler?
Well, when my diapers were ripped off at age one or two by an owl, I thought there may be an issue. It apparently ripped the diapers off of me and flew off with the diaper. So at that point, I think, is when the adventure began. But, I mean, you know, there was never a boring moment. We were always traveling with Pop and always getting into some pretty hairy, as you said, situations. I was in fourth or fifth grade, we went to Africa, and we were staying in a tent, a big tent with all these British expats around, and we were in Manapools, Zimbabwe, which was at the time a really wild place, and I think it still is. I mean, Zimbabwe is definitely a destabilized area, I think. But we were on the Zambezi River, which is where all those crocodiles are, where they just sit and wait for something to move. So that was a lot of fun. And I remember that we were, you know, sitting under a tent in our family tent, and Dad was making, strangely enough, he found lemons. I don't know where he found them, but he was making lemonade. And a huge elephant walks up, smells the lemons, rips the tent off the ground, so we're all inside the tent, and the tent stakes in the front of the tent, it rips off the ground because it's trying to get this lemonade. And I remember the expats, the British guys, all cracking up, and we had to cut our way out the back of the tent. And you know, that was a typical family vacation with Jungle Jim. Not to mention the time, that same trip, where we were chased by a herd of elephants. And you know, I thought it was cool we were in a Land Rover and we were, you know, driving through all these river valleys, I mean all these riverbeds, and all of a sudden, we see this dust storm and all these elephants charging, and Dad's going, "Oh, everything's fine, Mark. Don't worry. See how nice the elephants are." And I look in front of us, and the guys are cocking their M16s and getting ready to fire on these elephants. And luckily, nothing happened. But that was the typical Fowler, you know, Fowler follies, the Fowler excursion.
So you went off to college. Well, for a while, you were working with Birds of Prey.
Yeah, I. In seventh grade, I got into falconry, and Steve Hoddy was sort of my apprentice under Steve Hoddy, who was a great falconer.
Right.
And my first bird I got, actually they had sprayed some pesticide in the trees around our property in Connecticut, and the pesticide had killed a mother, a female red shoulder. So it had fallen out of the nest, and we tried to save it, but it was too late. And then a chick fell out of the nest, a small red shoulder baby that hadn't fledged yet, fell out of the nest. It was on the ground, and we picked, you know, we nursed it back to health, and then trained it to a hack box, which I'm sure you know what that is, but it's where you put out food. You put out food every day, and you basically train it back to the wild. So you're not touching it, but you let it free fly and then come back for food so that it doesn't starve, and eventually it becomes independent and flies off. So that was my first bird. So, you know, I had a red shoulder at, you know, in seventh grade or something like that. And then we had, you know, I had a Harris hawk, which was my favorite bird I ever had. A Harris hawk is just a beautiful, amazing hawk that had been injured, and we nursed it back to health as well. And I could fly that in the backyard in the backwoods in Connecticut. So that was, you know, eighth grade when I was really into that. And then from that point on, I just whenever I had free time, I apprenticed, you know, under Steve and went, you know, all around when he was lecturing, and just fell in love with, you know, birds of prey you know, falconry is an amazing, you know, 5,000-year-old sport. So it's definitely a passion of mine today, for sure.
Well, I remember the summer that you and Steve came by for a while.
Yeah, so do I.
For a week or two. It was a lot of fun, and that's when we were based in Indianapolis.
Absolutely, man. In fact, didn't we do the Indianapolis 500? Was that the same year that Dad did? He was the host of the Indianapolis 500. He was in the pace car, I remember.
Oh, he was?
And I thought he was in the pace car, and then I think we came out to your place and hung out with you, Steve and I.
Yeah.
And were you guys, I think you and Steve, were you guys doing animal shows together? Is that what we were doing?
Well, what we did, a big event in a little town west of Indianapolis. It was like a rodeo arena, if you remember.
Yeah.
And what was amazing was that Steve flew his Peregrine Falcon at night.
Oh.
Wow. Yes, he did. In fact, he did the deal where it was up on a tree. He got to go up into a tree, and then he was going to have it fly between my legs and then back to
him. No way.
Yeah. At night.
Wow. Now, that's interesting. You definitely don't want to be hit between the legs at 100 miles an hour.
Well, when you see that bird coming toward you, and all of a sudden it's just about ready to go between your legs, and it just does a slight shift to the right or to the left. I'll tell you what.
It's a little scary.
It's mind-blowing.
And yeah. Then, it's, of course, they're amazing. They're such amazing animals, you know, peregrines. I mean, they blow me away. And Steve is one of the top guys with those, you know.
Well, we'll talk about it when we have him on, but I can still remember going down to Wikiwachi, Florida, and he was in the in the woods because his macaw had flown away.
Yeah, man. In fact, you know, that's where Dad got his start. I don't know when you guys talked on your last show. Mm-hmm. That's where he got his start, was Silver Springs and Wikiwachi, and that's actually where Steve and Dad met. And Steve was Dad's apprentice. So it's interesting how small a world it is, you know.
That's wild. So you went to college.
Let me tell you something about Steve's bird, by the way.
Oh,
that falcon of his, that same falcon, I was once flying it, and I picked it up off its perch, and because it's already in its mind, it's already bonded with Steve.
Yeah.
The minute I picked it up, it decided that I was a threat to it. So we started flying it that day, and it started dive bombing me with its talons out. And I had to run inside this shelter. And from that point on, anytime I was outside, it would start dive bombing me. And also anyone else who looked like me, it would start dive bombing in the audience. So obviously I stopped working with that hawk immediately. With that falcon, excuse me. Anyway, so go ahead. Yes, on to college.
I can just see that.
Yeah. Don't ever mess with another man's peregrine. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I'll remember that. So,
for sure.
So you go on to college, and then you went off to Europe for a while, right?
Yes, but I don't recall that time, so I better not. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, I went to University of Colorado and majored in natural sciences and majored in basically I was a junior ranger up there in the Front Range of Colorado, and actually studying falcons. There were prairie falcons nesting and golden eagles nesting up in the Front Range.
Rocky
so
Mountain.
that was a pretty amazing part of the college experience, was hiking up there, you know, every day and taking notes on their mating and their you know, basically everyday notes and field notes on these birds of prey. That was a really fun part of it. And also, you know, college at University of Colorado is always never a boring moment either. So,
well, you probably don't remember this, but I talked to you when you were trying to make the decision on what college to go to.
No, did you really?
Yes.
And
I
what
did
you tell me? Oh, I think I do remember this. What did you tell me?
I told you the University of Colorado, and if you didn't go there, you were a fool.
Well, there you go, man.
And there,
there
you
go.
I forget what the other schools were, but when you said that.
Well, no. One of them was the Quaker school that Dad and all my relatives went to.
Earlham.
Earlham. And when they told me that things slowed down for them, they told me things slowed down for them after high school, I decided definitely on University of Colorado.
Yes, absolutely.
But, yeah, that was an amazing experience. And, you know, the Front Range of Colorado is just unbelievably beautiful. So all the hiking and all of the camping you can do up there. That was an amazing 4 years, and I graduated surprisingly, and then went on to get back into falconry actually and start educating again.
But you had bigger goals. You decided you wanted to get in this film production. In fact, your wife's involved with it as well.
Yeah, actually, when I was doing Birds of Prey shows with Steve after college, you know, my college girlfriend wasn't very happy when I told her I wanted to become a falconer.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, her father said, "What the hell is a falconer, you bastard?"
Yeah.
So that was a little hard to explain to a Texan father that I was going to become a falconer and go on the road. But then I did that, and during that time, my wife got in touch with me and said, "I know you're on the road, but I'd love to get together sometime and catch up." And I immediately left working for Steve and raced to find my girlfriend, and Steve is not as pretty as the Falconer and his team were definitely not as pretty as my wife. So I immediately raced out of there, and we moved west, and actually moved out here to Santa Monica, and she went to the University of Southern California, USC Film School, which is one of the top film schools, and got her master's at USC. And at that same time, I was thinking about going to, get my master's in film and production. And I decided, you know what, it's much better to cut your teeth in the, my route was to cut my teeth in the real world. So I, that's when I teamed up with Dad and Carrie, and we started doing that show. It was cool because it was Emmy nominated. So not only was it fun, it was cool to be, for it to be recognized as a good show for education and all that stuff. So yeah, we did that from right after school. From 2000 to 2001, we produced that show and had a lot of fun. Even though working under Jungle Jim Fowler is also interesting because, see, if you're the son of Jungle Jim Fowler, it's sort of like being a bull elephant with the young elephants around. When Jungle Jim's around, he's not going to let himself be knocked off by the younger elephants or, overpowered by them. So, he's definitely the chief in charge. And that was good, I mean, let me tell you one thing. You asked me what it was like growing up with him as a dad. I remember, when I first started dating girls, I thought to myself, what are the rules? How does this thing work? And I, as any son would do, I went to Jungle Jim and said, "All right, Dad, so, I'm into this girl. What should I do?" And he said, "Well, the peacock spreads its feathers to attract the women." And I'm going, "What do you mean, Dad?" He's like, "Well, and also the mating ritual of the ostrich, the mating dance, it has red legs and a red neck." And I'm going, "This has no bearing on my life, Dad. Can you please clarify?" So having Jungle Jim as a dad, it wasn't great for relationship advice, but otherwise, there was never a boring moment. So yeah, that sort of brings us up to the production time, and that's what I did when my wife was in college, in grad school, and after that we got married in '02 up in Idaho in the mountains, and actually we were gonna fly a bird of prey at the wedding, but. Because who's up there is the Peregrine Fund is up in Boise, and they're an amazing group of falconers, man. They're the ones that saved the falcon when it was on the brink of extinction due to DDT. So we were going to work with them at the wedding, so we got married up there, and ever since then we started our company in 03, and we've been making films ever since.
What's some of the films now? We're going to talk about the one, The Hunt for the Samurai Subs, but what are some of the other ones that you've been involved with?
Sure. Our first series was, I don't know if you've ever heard of NOLS, the National Outdoor Leadership School.
Yeah.
They're like Outward Bound, but they're more hardcore than Outward Bound. They're sort of a, you know, it's not as much the personal struggle. It's more of a teamwork and leadership and, you know, and survival skills. So we teamed up with NOLS in 2003, and by 2004 we had secured funding for the series, and we shot a 6-part series in the backcountry in an amazing part of the country called the Wind River Wilderness, and it's one of the most remote wilderness areas in the country. So it's up in Wyoming.
Okay.
And we went in there and filmed a 35-day trek across this remote area, this remote wilderness. We had 6 cameramen and about 10 pack horses, because there was absolutely nothing automated could go in there. So we had about 6 cameramen and 10 pack horses with gear and food to keep the cameramen going. And then we followed 15 NOL students and instructors, and we followed their entire experience from going in really green to, you know, all of their trials and tribulations in the backcountry to coming out and, you know, changed people. I mean, they were totally changed and totally, you know, pretty badass when they got out of the wilderness. So we filmed their story, and we sold that to Discovery Networks, which owned Travel Channel at the time, and they aired our show. It was called Backcountry Boot Camp. They aired it on Travel Channel. And, yeah, so that was our first big series, and that aired in 2007, actually. And then after we shot that, we went to, I don't think I ever mentioned this to you, but we went to, we went and got our fully certified and did a show called Scuba Knots, did a pilot called Scuba Knots about young adventurers, young kids that are, you know, teenagers that do pretty amazing stuff down, you know, they're advanced open water scuba divers, and they do some pretty amazing stuff with NASA and with NOAA. So we filmed the pilot. We filmed the pilot episode for their series, and then that was 2006. 2006, yeah. And then an amazing thing happened, which was I probably told you about this original expedition, but in 1990, I was a coach on a climb up Kilimanjaro.
I heard about that.
Yeah, with Special Olympians.
Right.
And so we went up in 1990, and almost the entire group except for 5 athletes were turned back. And we were there climbing the Arrow Glacier with David Brashears, who did all those shows, you know, IMAX to the Limit and Everest to the Limit. And he's sort of the Everest guy. And, you know, we didn't make it up. So that was 1990. So, you know, 17 or 18 years later, we decided to try to give it another try, and teamed up with, we found all the athletes that had already, you know, many of them had already retired. We found all the Special Olympians and brought them back together, all the ones that didn't make it, and gave them the opportunity to go back if they trained really hard to go back to Africa and give Kilimanjaro a second try. So that was 2006. End of 2006, we put it back together, and in 2007, in January, we filmed a show called Elevation. It's a 1.5-hour film called Elevation, and it's about the story of them going back and attempting to climb Kilimanjaro, which is, you know, the tallest mountain in Africa,
right?
And almost 20,000 feet, and we filmed their story as they attempted to summit the mountain. So that was an amazing experience.
That would have to be, because, you know, we've done some things with the Special Olympics people, and they're just fantastic.
Absolutely, right? Man. And those athletes, I mean, I always say that they're coaching us, you know, because they have a much more simple way of looking at the world, and we get so caught up in the, you know, daily trials and tribulations and just, you know, the modern world of all the junk that's surrounding us. But they have a very simple perspective, and I learned a lot from – I actually was a coach on this second climb. And I learned a lot from the athlete who's a close friend of mine. He's autistic, and we climbed together. And I'll tell you, he was my inspiration. We made it all the way to the top, and, you know, just to make it up to that to the summer with those guys was just an incredible experience. Yeah,
and they probably appreciated it more than anyone would ever. I mean,
they blew us away. They were, you know, not to tell the entire story, but all the athletes made it after, you know, a good 9-day climb. They all made it together, and so the entire team finally all made it up. And man, celebrating up there on the summit was one of the most amazing, you know, moments of my life. So that was really a, you know, an amazing experience.
That's cool. Well, we're going to take a break. Man, Mark, fantastic.
Cool.
We're going to be back. This is Blog Talk Radio. This is Larry Batson's Wild World. We're going to have a few minutes of PSAs, and we'll be right back with J. Mark Fowler here on Larry Batson's Wild World.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Pat Green. The blood supply is at critically low levels, and you can help. Call the American Red Cross at 1-800-GIVE-LIFE. That's 1-800-GIVE-LIFE to schedule your appointment to donate blood. Your donation is critical because every 2 seconds someone in America needs blood. That's accident victims, surgical candidates, and cancer patients, just to name a few. Please donate blood and encourage your friends, family, and neighbors to give too. Please call the American Red Cross at 1-800-GIVE-LIFE or visit givelife.org to make your appointment. Thank you.
Take me fishing and show me how to drive the boat.
Take me fishing so I can tell you what a great dad you've been.
Take someone you love out on the water and see where the water takes you.
Take me fishing because I miss my boy.
Rediscover the joy of boating and fishing. Get information and get going at takemefishing.org.
Beauty, freedom, country, family. They're the values that make America strong and what our armed forces are fighting to defend.
While many talk about these ideals, without action, they are just empty words.
If you think America's military families deserve more, log on to thanksusa.org. It's a great way to thank our troops and give military families the gift of education.
Thanksusa.org. Scholarships for America's military families. You can make a difference.
We're Rascal Flatts. There's a place where ordinary people do extraordinary things every day. That place is called the American Red Cross. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn more.
Hi, this is Paul McCartney on behalf of RAD. If you're drinking, you can't drive my car or any car. Remember, if you're partying this holiday season, don't drink and drive. Got it? It's just not worth it. Doesn't make sense. Thank you.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
There are some visitors you'd just rather not see. Like your obnoxious brother-in-law, Louie.
Hey, everybody, we're here. Good to see you. When do we eat?
But then there are some visitors you just can't get enough of. To make your farm or ranch a more attractive place for the visitors you actually want to see, contact your local Natural Resources Conservation Service office. They can help you build the habitat wildlife loves. But as for Louie, try disconnecting the doorbell. This message brought to you by USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service and this radio station.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, 1 second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
Hello, everybody from the snow-covered Midwest. Oh, gosh. I just looked at the thermometer. It's 10 degrees outside today. Of course, most of the people in the country, they say, well, that's what we're dealing with, dude. But our guest tonight lives in sunny California, sunny Southern California. Film producer, son of Wild Kingdom star Jim Fowler. Mark Fowler is our guest tonight, and already, Mark, pretty good stuff.
Well, it's fun talking to you, Larry, because, we go way back. I do remember hanging out with you when I must have been in seventh grade, and it sounds like you haven't changed much.
Not really, not too much at all.
Still doing crazy things with wildlife.
We're still doing crazy things with wildlife. Our life's always an adventure. In fact, if you want a documentary, you could live at our home for a month, and it would be.
I think we could do that. We'll have to talk about that for Animal Planet show. Look at Larry Batson's Wild World.
That would be pretty cool. I mean, because people, you know, they see the crocodile hunters and the guys that have them.
The showmen,
well, the million-dollar zoos are connected with, where, as you know, most of these educators and lecturers across the country, you know, it's a tough go, and we have
a passion. It's a passion career instead of a steady income career. That's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, my vet who was out here helping us with a bear one day, one of the students that were here from the vet college said something about retirement. He turned around and looked at him and said, "There's no retirement when you're working with animals."
That's true. Hopefully, you go with your boots on, with a smile on your face, surrounded by wildlife. I don't think that's a bad way to go.
No, I don't think so either. And when I do go, I hope it's spectacular. And
I agree, man. I agree. In fact, I've always said to friends that, you know, if a wild animal, first of all, the odds of a wild animal, you know, attacking you in the wilderness are about 1/100th of a car hitting you on a road. But if there's a good way to go, I think it would be to a predator. You know, it'd be nice to have a polar bear take you out. I mean, it might be painful at the moment, but I mean, what a great way to go.
Oh, absolutely. And
some of the top predators on Earth. But that's not for kids. If there are any kids listening, don't try to approach a polar bear.
No, don't do that. Or swim by a stingray. That's bad, too.
That's true. That is absolutely right.
But anyway.
Don't do that either. But, yeah, man, it's great talking to you. And, you know, you asked me what my motivation has been. And, you know, to be honest, you know, Jim, my dad has inspired me to carry on the family legacy by doing these films and by trying to inspire people to get in the outdoors and you know, explore themselves. That's really what my mission's become.
So you finished the Kilimanjaro film, and what happens after that?
Well, that's where that's sort of where the next phase, our next phase kicks in, which is, you know, I'm a member of the Explorers Club, and actually, you know, we were just talking a few minutes ago, when I did the field work in Colorado, that's why I qualified, because you have to do field work. It's science, education, and the dissemination of knowledge. Those are the three ways to become a member. So it's science, dissemination of knowledge, and outreach. So in other words, I became a member, and I started. I actually sat down one night at a dinner, and I was sitting beside this guy. And this is what a wild place the Explorers Club is. I was sitting beside this guy, and I said to him, you know, so how did you become a member? And he said, I was a Navy captain. And I went, oh, interesting, okay, great. And I sort of was trying to figure out what he had done to become a member.
Right.
And about halfway through the dinner, somebody leans over and goes, "Do you know who that is?" And I said, "No, I guess he's a Navy guy." He goes, "That's Don Walsh. He went down to the Marianas Trench in the Trieste. He's the only living person that's ever been down to the Marianas Trench, which is 35,000 feet deep."
Whoa.
And I went, "Holy cow." And that was in 1950. He went down with Picard, with Jacques Picard. He went down and you know, I'm sitting here talking to this guy, and he said, "Mark, listen," he goes, "look, everybody thinks that the world has been explored, and it's all been done." And he said, "If you look at the oceans, we've only explored 5% of the oceans, and we have the oceans make up 3/4 of the earth." So he said, "You know, you need to reach out, because one of my missions has been to carry on the family legacy, has been to try to reach out to youth and inspire another generation of explorers, because in this fast-paced world we live in, it's really hard to get away from your iPhone and your iPod and your computer."
Right.
And apparently there's, you know, like a 90% drop in interest in the outdoors, which I've been told from outdoor retailers, that people just aren't interested anymore, the next generations. So I think what you do, which is, I know I don't want to get preachy here, but what you do with, you know, educating youth and getting them inspired about wildlife, that's amazing, because I mean, we got to, you know, I think it's important to reach out to the next generation. So that's what my mission sort of became, and we did a show called, it was sponsored by the Explorers Club and by NASA and NOAA. We teamed up with a group called the Scubanauts. I mentioned them before, but what we did was we brought 12 of them on an expedition where they had to prove themselves worthy of becoming student explorers in the Explorers Club. So we went to Hawaii, and we went, and these youth explorers, basically, they dove 2,000 feet deep in submersibles and studied, you know, underwater sea life. And then they climbed from the summit of Mauna Kea, which is, sorry, not the summit, excuse me, the from sea level on Mauna Kea, you know, which is on the Big Island. It's the tallest mountain in the world if you measure it from base to top. The base is 20,000 feet deep. So it's not like Everest. Everest is the highest mountain on Earth, and Mauna Kea is the tallest mountain on Earth. So they climbed from sea level to the summit in 3 days with carrying their own food and tents and everything else, and they had a Air Force SEER. I don't know if you know what an Air Force SEER is, but a SEER is a search, evade, rescue, no, search, escape, rescue, and evade. He's a special forces member. Mm-hmm. So this guy was their sort of their drill sergeant, bringing them up this mountain, and they really had to push themselves because all these kids live at sea level. So they had to really push themselves and climb 14,000 feet to the top of Mauna Kea. In 3 days, they made it to the top where there's the Keck Observatory, which is this amazing, you know, observatory into space, and the Smithsonian Observatory, and all these different arrays. So they climbed to the summit of Mauna Kea, which is snow covered in winter up in Hawaii. Not many people know that. They climbed to the summit, and from there, NASA took our expedition flag, our Explorers Club flag, and our expedition banner. They took it into space on behalf of youth exploration.
Whoa.
So this was called Operation Deep Climb, is what it was called. And these youth explorers, we went to Cape Canaveral and filmed the launch of our space shuttle as it went up to the International Space Station. And when they were up there, they unfurled the Explorers Club flag and the youth expedition flag, the Operation Deep Climb flag. And, you know, these kids all qualified to become student members of the Explorers Club. So that was sort of where the mission part of programming came in, and we started doing stuff alongside NASA, NOAA, and the Explorers Club. So that was an amazing expedition. That happened in 2008, it just really inspired us and all of the youth explorers, and that's sort of the direction we've been going in since.
That's fantastic. I've always heard there's nothing like witnessing the space shuttle in person.
Oh man, you're absolutely right. It was unbelievable, you know, because they shoot them off at night a lot of times, because that's when they have clear skies. And to see that space shuttle launch and knowing we had something, a stake in it, you know, that's mm-hmm. that's part of the amazing part of manned exploration, because we're at this point, you know, we are at a crossroads where we can continue manned exploration, or we can just, you know, a lot of bureaucrats would like to just completely cancel manned exploration and just go with robots. But as you know, when you're talking to a kid with a wild animal, he's much more interested in that wild animal and will care from that point on when it's in front of him than when he's looking at it on a 2D screen. So Absolutely. That point is, I think manned exploration and seeing something in person, you know, gives us the ability to care a lot more about it. And I think that's why, you know, the space program, I think, is really exciting for manned exploration and robotics, both combined.
So you're
tangent. That's a tangent. But anyway, go ahead.
No, that's fine. So you're in Hawaii with the young explorers, and is this when you first heard about the samurai subs, or were you aware of this before?
Good lead-in, man. Absolutely. You read my mind. In fact, I was out on that expedition. I was out doing the dive to it's called the Japanese midget subs. They're these little subs. They actually just did a an episode on Nova about this, but we were down with our scuba knots diving on the midget subs before they climbed the mountain, and we had a really great experience with the sub team called the Hawaii Undersea Research Labs. They're an amazing group that Don Walsh, who I mentioned about the Explorers Club, he had recommended I work with them, and I had called them up, and through the National Marine Sanctuaries and NOAA, I called them up and said, you know, we wanted to start working with them on this Operation Deep Climb. So we were out there diving, and the captain of the program, his name is Terry Kirby. He runs the Pisces Deep Submergence Vehicles, which are two DSVs that go 6,000 feet deep, and they're twin DSVs. So basically they're each other's safety. So you're untethered and you're diving up to 6,000 feet, and they're an amazing organization. So I was out there on this boat, and he said, we had one more dive day programmed in, and I said, look, man, you know, we've gone to the midget sub, we've done, you know, we've had a great time, but what's out there to discover, and what story is out there that we need to tell? And at that point, he said, look, I haven't shared this with many people, but we've just discovered a super, you know, remote and, you know, advanced Japanese submarine. And he said, you know, no one's ever done a story on it. And, you know, we need to get this story out there, and I think you're the right person for it, and we'd like to work with you on this. So at that point, he handed me this, you know, huge binder of research, because these guys had gone through 60 years of top secret, you know, top secret information that had been released. They're all Navy guys, and they sifted through everything and had found a potential location for this submarine. And during their test dives, they went down and they discovered this 400-foot submarine that was the largest of World War II. And the kicker of the story is that not only was it the largest, but it had an airplane hangar on the submarine where three bombers could fold up inside the submarine. And this was an aircraft carrying sub, so it could go 1.5 times around the world and emerge in New York City from Japan and could launch bombers off its bow, literally out of an airtight hangar. And these planes could, you know, the plan was for them to bomb our most important cities, New York and D.C. So they told me about this story, and I said, we're going down. So I said, let's do it. So
yeah.
I said, you're not, you know, I'm ready. So the next day we dove to 3,000 feet deep. And that was where the story began. And I shot a pilot in the submersible. We brought a cameraman down, and I hosted the pilot in a way and sort of shared the story. And we went down, and when we got down to about 3,000 feet, we just came upon this massive wall that was incredibly well preserved. But it turns out it was the hull of the ship. And this thing literally was seven stories high. So,
wow.
You know, we're when you get down in these submersibles, you're right above right above the sea floor. You're about a foot above the sea floor, sort of floating above the sea floor. And when we got to this, you know, literally this behemoth, we stop, and all of a sudden he turns upwards, and we start going up this thing. And literally, I mean, it was an amazing sight. So that's when I caught the bug about this story, the hunt for the samurai subs.
That had to be quite the where every hair on the back of your neck stands up when you see something like that.
Oh, man, absolutely. And, you know, diving in one of those things, I'll tell you about that experience. You know, going down in this submersible, when you hit the water, I mean, it's a 14-ton wrecking ball, but when you hit the water, you're in the surf zone. So it's only it's a 7-foot in diameter area inside these submersibles. So, but then you've got all the equipment. So now it's about a 5-foot in diameter area, and you've got 3 full-size adult men in it, or, you know, men and women. So it is super tight in these things. So if you have any claustrophobia, it's not a good idea to go down in one of these things.
Right.
And you start dropping, and then all of a sudden it becomes total blackness. You know, the light goes away and it's totally black. And then about 45 minutes later, you hit, you know, you're going about 100 feet a minute. And about 45 minutes later, you hit, 40 minutes later, you get to the seafloor. And when you do, and they turn on the lights, it's just a totally different world. I mean, it's, you know, life forms you've never seen before, and crazy see-through fish and all these weird, strange animals. And then you start going along the seafloor, and the crazy part about off of Pearl Harbor, you know, that's where we were, was sort of south of Pearl Harbor. What happens is there's you know, 60 years of military, you know, basically military weapons and stuff that have been dumped off there. So we were going along the seafloor, and we came across live torpedoes and live, you know, hedgehogs and all these crazy World War II, you know, weapons that have been either dropped there during the war or have been dumped there afterwards. And it was totally crazy being down there. So not only are you dealing with finding a submarine, but there's weapons live. They probably won't ever go off, but they're still there, and they have never, you know, they're probably live at the same time. So that was amazing. And then we finally reached the submarine, and it just blew my mind.
So these submarines, they were captured by the Navy, correct?
Yeah.
How did this all happen? They had a clue. Clue that they were real, and that they captured them.
Well, no. What's really fascinating about the story is the Japanese did an amazing job keeping them secret. So up until they were designed in 1944 after Pearl Harbor, because the Japanese saw that, you know, at Midway they saw that the Americans were starting to get the advantage in the Pacific. So that Admiral Yamamoto, who was the mastermind of Pearl Harbor, decided, okay, we're going to launch a massive attack on the mainland of the USA. And that was his way of saying, we're going to scare them so bad and attack them at their heart to where they will surrender the Pacific to us. In other words, they will give the Pacific to us, and we'll have full control, and they'll surrender. So that was his dream. So he built these. The plan was to build 20, up to 20, 18 to 20 of these submarines, these 400-foot submarines. They're called the I-400. He wanted to build 20 of those with 3 planes in each. So you're talking about almost 50 to 60 attack planes, okay? And he wanted to take those around the world, literally to New York and D.C., launch them, and, you know, I mean, think about if 50 planes launched and attacked New York City. I mean, you know, we all know how horrible 9/11 was. You know, this would have been, in World War II, it would have been insane. So,
yeah.
So that was the plan, and what happened was they essentially the war kept going on, and the Japanese kept having to retreat. So Yamamoto was killed by the Air Force and the Army. The Air Force actually is who killed Yamamoto. They shot him down. So at that point, they switched the target to the Panama Canal, and they were going to destroy the Panama Canal with these submarines and with these aircraft carrier submarines. They were going to launch and fly over the Panama Canal across into the Atlantic side, and then come up and destroy the Atlantic side of the Panama Canal. That was their plan. And it was going to be kamikaze attacks at this point, because, you know, with about 1945, the Japanese were doing kamikaze attacks, and that was sort of the standard operating procedure at that point because they were getting desperate. So they were going to do kamikaze attacks and destroy the Panama Canal with the hopes of stopping the Allies from rearming in the Pacific. But then the war, we won Okinawa, and the war got, you know, quickly it became defending the homeland. And in 46, August of 46, I believe, they were in the midst of an attack. Our submarines, there were three aircraft-carrying submarines in the midst of an attack going after the Ulithi Atoll, which was our main staging area for the invasion of Japan. And there were hundreds of ships there. And there were tons of aircraft carriers, American aircraft carriers, destroyers, everything. So these are pilots who are all kamikazes, and the three subs were approaching at night with getting prepared for their attack. And they heard over the San Francisco radio that literally they could hear San Francisco radio out in the Pacific as it travels. So they were spying on American radio signals, and they heard that Japan had surrendered. And this is the night before the morning attack. So they hear that Japan has surrendered from an American radio station, and they report this to the captain, who was this take no prisoners, you know, hardcore Japanese loyal Marine who basically was known, notorious for never taking prisoners. And this guy refuses to accept that there had been a surrender, so he continues the attack on the Ulithi Atoll. And the next day, Hirohito comes out and announces the surrender or the ceasing of hostilities. He announces it. So this captain refuses to surrender, and he continues until the crew says, you know, we have orders to surrender. And he tells the crew that they should all scuttle the ships, scuttle the planes, and all go down with them, all men on board. So he wanted them all to sacrifice themselves in these submarines to hide them from the Americans. And they refused, and he went downstairs into his captain's quarters and committed suicide to preserve the honor of his, you know, his subs. And his, you know, the commander sacrificed himself, sort of like old Japanese samurai. That's where the samurai subs comes from, is because they were operating in sort of a World War II samurai code, is how they were operating at that time. So that's where the story begins, is this captain, you know, kills himself, and they surrender the submarines. And at the time, they're racing back to Japan, trying to get back into Japanese waters instead of having Americans take them. So we found these vets who were on the boarding parties of these destroyers that chased down these submarines. They chased them down. They boarded the subs with Tommy guns, and they were each issued a Tommy gun and a 9mm. And they boarded these submarines and demanded the surrender. And there was no violence.
No violence.
They were peacefully surrendered. They captured three aircraft carrying submarines and two fast attack submarines. So those are the submarines that we started searching for. And the way the story goes is these submarines emerged from the depths, and the Americans, the Allies, had never seen them. They had no idea the Japanese. I will shorten the story up quick because I know we're running out of time, but they had no idea these submarines even existed. So when we captured them, they were so advanced, we brought them back to Pearl Harbor. We started studying them. We got all the intel we could off of these subs. And then the Russians demanded that they wanted one of each of these advanced submarines, these fast attack and these aircraft carrying subs. And when they demanded that, we found the commander who brought them off of Pearl Harbor and torpedoed them and sunk them in deep waters where they thought no one would ever find them. And this was to keep them away from the Russians, honestly. And they torpedoed all of them. They sank to the bottom, you know, they kept virtually no records of where they sank them, and that was where our story begins, and we went down there and went searching for the samurai subs, and, you know, I hope people see the film, but we were able to find new discoveries, and we found two more submarines.
Wow. Well, Mark, it's been fantastic.
Hey, man, it's great talking to you too, Larry.
I want to have you back on again. Cause there's
I'd love
more.
To. Next time we do a project, I'll definitely give you a call and keep up the great work. Keep up the great work with all the wildlife, man. It sounds like you guys are having fun too.
Yeah, we are. This is Blog Talk Radio. This is Larry Batson's Wild World. We'd like to thank Eric Altman in Pennsylvania for making sure this show's on the air. This is Larry Batson. We'll see you next week, 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Larry Batson's Wild World. Have a great week, everybody.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Larry Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.